From Iowa Public Radio News, I'm Ben Kiefer. This is The Exchange. It's Politics Day here on The Exchange. WikiLeaks is the big news of the week. We'll look at some of the revelations coming out of the leaked diplomatic cables and their potential impact on U.S. diplomacy in the future. And the impact of an extensive Pentagon study measuring the attitudes of servicemen and women on Don't Ask, Don't Tell. At a state level, we'll be talking about the transition from one gubernatorial administration to the next. My guests this week, political scientist Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa and New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson. Politics Day here on The Exchange, right after the news. It's The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Great to have you with us over the noon hour for this Politics Wednesday. And joining us as our guests for this Wednesday, Chris Larimer, Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa, joining us from Iowa Public Radio Studios in Cedar Falls. Good afternoon to you, Chris.
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me, Ben.
Great to have you back on our program. Also, always great to have Arnie Arneson joining us by phone from New Hampshire, New Hampshire political analyst. Arnie, are you there?
I am here, and it's a mild, mild Wednesday in New Hampshire, so I'm quite lucky.
Well, we've had our first blast of cold here in the Midwest, so anyway, let's move on to politics because that is our charge this hour. We want to reach out to our listeners because we will be talking about a number of things, of course, in the political news, WikiLeaks. We want to start off with that. Also, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and Obama meeting with the GOP at the White House, also the transition of from Culver to Branstad on our docket for today. And we want to start off with WikiLeaks. The U.S. government has said it will tighten security after WikiLeaks released more than 250,000 U.S. diplomatic cables, including candid views of foreign leaders and blunt assessments of security threats. Exchange listeners, what do you think should happen to the people responsible for this leak? Is it treason, or is it valuable for us to know, for the world to know? Does it help our understanding of how diplomacy works? 1-866-780-9100 is our toll-free number to get in on this conversation initially about WikiLeaks. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. And, of course, the revelations continuing. We heard it right there in the news at the top of the hour. Let me go to each of you for your thoughts. First of all, let's go to Chris Larimer.
Well, I think the frank assessments by diplomats about what was going on in other countries, about the ideology of particular leaders, I think most people expected that was going on. I think what has been surprising and what continues to be surprising is the relationship between other countries. I think most of our policies are and what was said and the cables are pretty consistent with what most people expected. But when you start talking about the relationship between some Arab nations and Iran or between North Korea and China, I think those are starting to be some of the more surprising revelations.
Mm-hmm. When someone is described as feckless, vain, and ineffective as the Italian Prime Minister, Silvio Berlusconi, was, does that change the way we conduct diplomacy with the European Union, with Italy? Or do these people have such a thick skin? Do they assume this is going on so that it just rolls off their back like water off a duck?
Well, I think a little bit of both. You know, all of these people had to run their own campaigns, so a lot of this came out when they were running for elected office in the first place. I think with Silvio Berlusconi, the interesting relationship there is with Russia and with Vladimir Putin, and kind of as we see more and more cables about that, I think it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
Arnie Arneson, your thoughts on WikiLeaks thus far?
Well, again, nothing was shocking, and your conversation about Berlusconi, that's exactly what he is. I mean, I think he probably takes it as a compliment. Well, you've noticed. I mean, you know, I mean, and I mean, if you read The Economist about Berlusconi, if you read any of them, they have called him things that are much more, how shall I say, edgy than what you just quoted me from the WikiLeaks. But I wanted to read a quote because the late Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who walked in every branch of government, wrote about his concern about secrecy and democracy. And I want to read you this quote. The central and enduring problem of the security system is that secrets are frequently wrong. And it was a warning because as he was leaving, he realized what was going on, and that it was really almost a corrosive effect on our democracy. And I think there are things that are so frustrating. For example, what we learned about Saudi Arabia. So what Saudi Arabia was doing vis-a-vis Iran reminds me of what the Republicans did with health care. What happened was we had a health care reform plan that was very much what Republicans had claimed they had wanted for a decade. But they didn't have to put their fingerprints on it. They didn't have to vote for it. In fact, they could vote against it. And if it passed, they got what they wanted. And if it failed, they got what they wanted. Well, Saudi Arabia did the same thing. It wanted the U.S. and Israel to basically get rid of Iran, but it didn't want to have anything to do with it. It didn't want to have its fingerprints on it. It didn't want to be associated with it, but it wanted to applaud it in the background. And I think that is what is so frightening, is to read some of the conversation between many of the Middle Eastern countries where their goals and their aims sound very much like Israel. God forbid we should say that out loud. But on top of that, what you also read in Saudi Arabia is that Saudi Arabia is funding Al-Qaeda. So here we are, you know, inviting them to George Bush's, you know, ranch in Texas. Here we are talking about them as a great ally. And then as you read from WikiLeaks, you find out that they are saying one thing and doing the exact opposite. From someone who cares about young men and women going to war, us spending how many millions, if not billions, if not trillions of dollars on fighting in the Middle East, and then to see how these players are operating, I think WikiLeaks turns out to be an important bit of sunlight on something that the American people need to understand, because we are the ones that are being asked to sacrifice.
New Hampshire political analyst Arnie Arneson with us this hour. Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa, political scientist. Join our conversation, 1-866-780-9100. Former GOP presidential candidate Mike Huckabee was interviewed at a book signing this week where he had this to say about WikiLeaks.
Whoever in our government leaked that information is guilty of treason. And I think anything less than execution is too kind a penalty. They have put American lives at risk. They put relationships that will take decades to rebuild at risk. And they knew full well that they were handling sensitive documents. They were entrusted. And anyone who had access to that level of information was not only a person who understood what their rules were, but they also signed under oath a commitment that they would not violate it. They did. And I believe they have committed treason against this country, and any lives they endangered, they're personally responsible for, and the blood is on their hands.
Former Arkansas Governor, Mike Huckabee, winner of the 2008 Iowa caucuses, by the way, also considered a frontrunner for 2012. His view on WikiLeaks. And we're reaching out to our listeners. What should happen to the people responsible for this leak? Is it treason? As Mike Huckabee says there, let's go to our phones. Dan is in Des Moines. Good afternoon, Dan. What are your thoughts on WikiLeaks?
I think WikiLeaks is a great thing. And I think that despite some of my commitment to people that are patriotic and their concerns about the leaks, I think the leaks were good. Not unlike the painful truth that Daniel Ellsberg had with the Pentagon Papers. This is not something. Most of this information really is not new to the people out there that are fighting in the trenches. It is new to the rest of us in the cheap seats and the people out there in the countryside. Yeah, we don't read about it unless you happen to extrapolate from John Le Carre or Tom Clancy, you realize this stuff has always been going on.
But Dan, don't you have concerns? I understand that you like the openness, the transparency that this provides us, but isn't there mixed with that concerns about U.S. security and concerns that this is going to make Hillary Clinton's job, first and foremost, and all the people she works with, very much more difficult?
That's grossly overstated. They're overplaying their card. Everybody around the country that has to go through any kind of significant political course or discourse knows that every single State Department position has always been a front line for intelligence. It's been going on historically. If we forgot history and what happened back in the Soviet era with what we were doing in the Eastern Bloc, what we've done in the past, what all the countries play the same basic game. They've always done it, and you can go back to the Prince, Machiavelli's stuff. You just have to extrapolate that to today. You can look at the politics of your small town in Iowa, and you can just translate that to a small town in in Romania, you know, which we, you know, Bucharest, which is really not that small of a town, but basically, same stuff happens.
Dan, thank you very much for that call from Des Moines. Excellent points. Arnie, before we go to our next caller, what did you want to jump in with?
And the reason I want to jump in is that Dan and the Defense Secretary, Robert Gates, actually are in somewhat of agreement. It has been overblown. In fact, this is exactly what Robert Gates said. Now, I've heard the impact of these releases on our foreign policy described as a meltdown, as a game changer, and so on. I think those descriptions are fairly significantly overwrought. This is Robert Gates. The fact is, governments deal with the United States because it is in their interest, not because they like us, not because they trust us, and not because they believe we can keep secrets. Is it an embarrassment? Yes. Is it awkward? But I think the consequences for U.S. foreign policy are fairly modest. Okay? This is Defense Secretary Robert Gates. So our caller and Mr. Gates seem to be reading from the same page.
Okay, Dan in Des Moines, thank you for your observations. Let's move on to Joshua in Cedar Rapids. Hi, Joshua.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As far as WikiLeaks, I think that the individual in the Army that took the information, obviously he was in a verbal and written agreement with our military and our government that he was going to be privy to information he was not allowed to do certain things with. He's guilty. There's no ifs, ands, and buts about that in my eyes. But as far as the WikiLeaks guy, I think he's protected. You know, if I remember back to my government class about the Pentagon Papers, he's kind of protected by the First Amendment. Well, for one, he's not even American, so I don't even know if that's...
And they're trying to find him. He's on Interpol's wanted list now, isn't he?
But it sounds like none of this information was, like, giving away how to build a nuclear bomb or, you know, how the Secret Service protect the president. If it was that kind of information, yes, that needs to be tied up. And maybe, if anything, this proves that we need better locks in place. You know, the reason better locks are built is because someone hacks into something or someone breaks into something. We design a better system and change our policies, procedures to protect that information. And one last comment, I'm afraid this would set a precedent to give more reason why we should censor the Internet. I'm a believer that the Internet should be free, but when stuff like this happens, I always kind of clinch because it's like, this is just going to be further evidence why they want to be able to lock down the Internet or close it down or censor it in some way.
Oh, I understand that. Thank you, Joshua. Two good observations there. Those locks are being crafted as we speak to button this down and give people less access to those diplomatic cables that were leaked, no doubt about that. I want to ask Arnie Arneson and Chris Larimer about the political fallout for this. Does the political fallout differ for the GOP versus the Democratic Party? Any difference in the repercussions for the political parties in WikiLeaks? Chris?
I guess I don't see any difference in terms of the effect on either benefiting Democrats or benefiting Republicans or hurting one party or the other. I think what's probably most shocking for most people is that after the Bush administration, there was this sense of, okay, we have a new presidential administration. We see America's standing in the world starting to improve. And then you have this massive leak of information with very frank statements about other countries, about other diplomats, about other heads of state. And it sort of is this sort of – it reverses the trend of, oh, hey, you know, we all feel good about the United States. We all feel good about what they're doing. And now we have these very frank assessments, and it's kind of back to reality in terms of foreign policy.
But aren't you a little surprised that after 9/11, I mean, now they make us take off our shoes, and now we're going through body scanners, and now we're being groped, and now they're checking this, and they're checking that. And it is no shock that there are people that are able to hack. It is no shock that because of technology transfer, large amounts of information can be obtained pretty easily. You would have thought that since we've gotten so anal and so neurotic about everything since 9/11, that the government wouldn't have anticipated this. I mean, this is the part that absolutely amazes me. They're going to tell me that every time I walk into an airplane because of some guy that never was successful in blowing up an airplane, that they have to know every part of my body cavity. But the government is shocked because these thousands and thousands of pages get released. I'm just a little confused as to where they build the walls and where they don't.
And that is being revised as we speak. Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire political analyst, Chris Larimer with us, the University of Northern Iowa political scientist. Let's move on from WikiLeaks to some concerns in the state. The transition from Governor Culver to Governor-elect Branstad. Yesterday, Governor-elect Branstad announced that Debbie Durham would serve as director of the Iowa Department of Economic Development. She is the president of the Siouxland Area Chamber of Commerce, president of the Siouxland Initiative. That's an economic development group. Durham says she plans to approach the challenge of creating 200,000 new jobs in Iowa in a bipartisan way.
My approach to everything is extremely collaborative. And you will also find that I will work with all parties, with labor, obviously, and management. All of that is important because there is nothing more worthy than us putting Iowans back to work and raising the median income for our citizens. So I can't imagine any greater job.
Debbie Durham there. And any surprise in that when we come out of the chute, a new administration lines up? Chris, always talking about bipartisanship, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's still kind of have that feel-good feel or that feeling that left over after the election, you know, only about 30 days out. So no surprise there. And the pick of Debbie Durham I don't think is a real surprise given the staff of Governor-elect Branstad's campaign. You know, these were always longtime insiders within the Republican Party. Debbie Durham, obviously the choice for lieutenant governor in 2002 with Doug Gross. And so, you know, I don't think there are any surprises there.
Mm-hmm. How will this administration be different in its approach? Can we tell at this point we have a moderate Republican taking over from a moderate Democrat? Any difference there?
I'm not sure if we can tell anything as far as the approach just yet. I think what will be interesting will be the dynamic between the House and the Senate and how Governor-elect Branstad wants to deal with that. Obviously, within the Iowa House, you have some very fiscal conservatives and some very social conservatives who were elected to the Iowa House, and they now have a very big majority in the Iowa House. Compare that with the Iowa Senate, and you know it's still a slim majority for the Democrats. I think for Governor-elect Branstad, it's going to be trying to figure out, you know, how do I play off this? Can he just let the House kind of do whatever they want in terms of policies, whether they are extreme in terms of social or fiscal conservative, and then just rely on the Senate essentially to block any proposals that he would normally say are too extreme, but just doesn't want to say in public.
And Ben, may I make a comment here? Although I don't necessarily am engaged with Iowa politics in particular, but I can speak generically about what states are facing. And that is, it is not surprising what you said about this bipartisan nature. They are going to see less money from the federal government. Earmarks are basically now being described as a thing of the past, and everyone hates earmarks except the earmarks that come to Iowa or the earmarks that come to New Hampshire.
Right.
You know how it is. And as a result, you better work bipartisanly because you're going to have to do it alone. I mean, really what's going to happen with the Republicans in control of Congress is when they talk about cutting spending, that is money going to states. When they're talking about cutting spending, those are your ethanol subsidies, and those are your subsidies for corn and everything else. When they're talking about those kinds of cuts, what that means is that you're on your own, Jack, and you're going to have to work between communities inside those states, and states are much more willing to work in a bipartisan fashion than the federal government. The federal government is almost paid to act like jerks. They're not supposed to talk to each other. They've been told, they've been sent so much money to act like I'm right and you're wrong. Well, at the end of the day, they don't really control anything except for their little territory in Washington, and it's at the state level where governors, the buck stops there.
Mm-hmm.
They're responsible for what happens in the counties and what happens in the communities. So I think that while it sounds like, you know, the right kind of language at the very beginning of an administration, it's the only kind of approach that will ultimately work, especially with less and less support from the federal government as a result of huge deficits.
Talking about the transition from Culver to Branstad with Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire political analyst, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. Transitions, of course, are never easy, but this one may be especially difficult. David Roeder is leading Governor-elect Branstad's transition team. He says this transition is different than those in the recent past.
It's been 50 years since an incumbent governor has been defeated. So this hasn't happened very often. Generally in Iowa, what we've had is the outgoing administration has been leaving voluntarily. And so this has made it a little more of a challenge.
Okay, David Roeder there. Talk about that a little bit more, Chris Larimer. We have two rivals, one handing off to the other. This hasn't happened for a long time. So what are the difficulties of transition and this transition in particular?
Well, I suppose the difficulties are particularly in terms of just making the transition prior to January 14th when Branstad takes the oath of office with, you know, no incumbent governors having been defeated in 50 years, as Dave Roeder said. You can't really prepare in advance, right? So this was really came down to Election Day, although most people knew kind of what the election result would be. But now it's kind of this scramble to fill all these positions. You know, there wasn't, you know, Governor-elect Branstad could not prepare the last year as far as the transition team and the transition staff. Having said that, the people he surrounded himself with are people who have been in his administration in the past or that he knows from previous positions. And so I don't see it as being as difficult as if it was Governor Culver being defeated by someone who had never held the executive office in Iowa prior to this.
Tell us a little bit more about who's most affected by such changes. When you have a change at the top in the governorship, only higher-level people, directors affected, or how far down does it go?
Usually it's the higher-level directors. I mean, in particular when you're talking about the budget. So you have Dave Roederer is leading the transition team. He's going to be director of the Department of Management. So he's going to be the one who's in charge of the budget. And that's where an administration sets their policy priorities. And so that's where you're going to see a lot of turnovers, where anything dealing with budget, finance, taxes, and as we've seen so far, director of inspection and appeals. There was, Governor-elect Branstad ran on this idea of cutting back on regulations, that Iowa was overregulated. So anyone in a top-level position that deals with regulations, whether it's healthcare or corporate regulation, you're going to see turnover.
Mm-hmm. Priorities? Remind us of the priorities we can tell at this point of the Branstad administration.
Well, I think the priorities are cutting corporate taxes. That seems to be a big one. I don't think he's going to deal with the gay marriage issue that was so prominent in the election. I think he's going to leave that to the Iowa House and the Iowa Senate to then defeat what the Iowa House does or just not bring it up at all. So I think, property taxes and, of course, his jobs promise about creating 200,000 jobs. We really have no idea how he's going to do that. He said he has this new director of Department of Economic Development, and then he's also going to create this new Office of Economic Progress that's supposed to be a public-private partnership. But we've yet to see how that's going to shake out.
How much will we average Iowans notice in the way government changes over the next few years under the Branstad administration? Will we?
It'll take a little bit of time because it will be kind of shifting budget priorities around. If we see it in sort of corporate tax breaks, or we may see it with regard to preschool. That was one of the big differences between Culver and Branstad was funding for preschool education. Culver was in favor of universal funding. Branstad was in favor of funding for only for those individuals who cannot afford preschool. And so if you have young children, you may see an effect rather immediately.
Okay. Assistant Professor of Political Science at the University of Northern Iowa with us this hour, Chris Larimer. In addition to Arnie Arneson joining us from New Hampshire, political analyst. And when we come back after a short break, we want to tackle a couple of other political items in the news. Don't ask, don't tell. A new study, 9 months of a study, and we'll talk about that study and its effects on the possible repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and get your opinion. What are your thoughts on the repeal? Possible repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, 1-866-780-9100. We also want to talk about this meeting this week at the White House that President Obama had with GOP leaders. We'll talk about what may get done here in this lame duck session, what may be left for the new Congress, and why. We'd like your input this hour, 1-866-780-9100. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org. We're also on Twitter at IPR Talk. When we come back, Obama and the GOP, and Don't Ask, Don't Tell. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. Great to have you with us over the noon hour. This is The Exchange from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Tomorrow at 10 o'clock, my colleague Charity Nebbe will have on Talk of Iowa, Capturing the Beauty of Iowa in Photographs. She'll talk with photographers Linda and Robert Scarth and Bill Witt. Tune in tomorrow at 10 o'clock. Tomorrow at this time, over the noon hour, we'll be talking about the role of the Iowa caucuses. Of course, we're launching into campaign season leading up to 2012. We'll talk with Iowa University of Iowa Political Science Professor Carolyn Tolbert and former University of Iowa Professor David Redlosk about their new book, Examining the Iowa Caucuses, tomorrow at this time. Today, of course, it's Politics Wednesday, and discussing a number of items in the news. We wanted to talk this half hour about Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the possible repeal of that in the military, and also President Obama meeting with the GOP on the eve of the GOP taking over in the House in the new Congress. And let's start with Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Our guests this week, by the way, if you weren't with us the first half hour, Arnie Arneson, New Hampshire political analyst, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. After 9 months of study and unprecedented polling of the nation's troops, the Pentagon concluded Tuesday that allowing gays and lesbians to serve openly posed a, quote, low risk of disruption. The report found that a large majority of troops were comfortable with the prospect of overturning longstanding restrictions on gays in uniform, and that they expected it would have little or no effect on their units. This can be done and should be done without posing a serious risk to military readiness. Those are the words of Defense Secretary Robert Gates. He urged the Senate to pass legislation before it adjourns this month. So, Exchange listeners, what are your thoughts on the possible repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell? 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email, also on Twitter at IPR Talk. Let me start with you, Arnie Arneson. How does this report change the picture for the effort to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
Well, what I think is interesting is that it kind of proved what we all knew in our gut. It turns out that the Marines were the ones that were the most reluctant, and everybody else was like, okay, go for it. It turned out that when you actually read an interview between the two gentlemen that were required to do the report, that they thought that there'd be a demographic, you know, difference. They thought that there'd be an age difference in how people responded. And they were actually surprised because, you know, the old cadres were as willing to accept it in some ways as the young. So it didn't necessarily have a line of demarcation based on age or other issues of demographics. But what I did want to talk about is I think what Defense Secretary Gates said when he was really appealing to the Congress to pass this and pass this now. Don't have a court step in. Don't delay this any longer. It's almost it's been brewing for such a long period of time. He was asked personally what he thought of this. And I want these words to be part of our conversation. He said, "We spend a lot of time in the military talking about integrity and honor and values. One of the things that is most important to me is personal integrity, and a policy or a law that in effect requires people to lie gives me a problem." Mm. And again, these are people who are going to rely on each other about their lives. You know, they're going into these very intense military situations, and to create this idea that somehow you're obligated to lie makes no sense to him. And yet within minutes after this happened, there was a letter that just came to Senator Reid this morning, and basically Don't Ask, Don't Tell was thrown out the window again by the Republicans saying, we're not going to negotiate on anything. So, you know, Gates made the appeal yesterday, and within hours, the Republicans seemed to eject it.
It seems the bill's fate rests largely on the votes of about 10 moderate senators of both parties. They were waiting. They had said up to this point, let's wait and see what the report has to say. So, Chris Larimer, what's your read on this? How likely is it to get repealed before the new Congress in January?
Well, like Arnie said, the Senate leadership just sent a letter this morning saying basically we are not going to deal with any other issue unless we get the issue of tax cuts resolved before mm-hmm. December 31st. And so I think it really is on hold, even though, as Arnie said, if you look through the report, there is widespread empirical support for repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell across demographic groups. So really it is just the Marine Corps and Senator McCain who are basically the only folks who are left saying that this is a bad idea. But again, the Republican leadership this morning has said that unless tax cuts are dealt with first, this is not going to be addressed.
1-866-780-9100 to get your opinion, your question about Don't Ask, Don't Tell. 1-866-780-9100, The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org, our email. Jacob is joining us from Belmont. Hi, Jacob.
Hey, man, how are you? I actually got two comments.
Sure, go ahead.
The first one is about the study itself. I actually heard it was on family radio. I didn't look this up myself, but, I mean, I don't think these people are lying to me. Basically, they were questioning the credibility of the survey because the way that they asked the question and they phrased it to people, they basically didn't ask them whether or not they were okay with repealing it. They asked them how they would feel if it was repealed. So mm-hmm. it's not like you're really saying, you know, do you guys want it repealed? You know, it's sort of misleading. So it gives the impression that people are in support of it when, in reality, it's really asking, you know, if this happens, how are you going to deal with it?
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of my question on that. The second comment is there's a lot of talk about, you know, most people are pretty much okay with it, but the Marines aren't. Well, if you talk to most people, you know, in the armed forces or whatever, you know, who's the most respected group of people? It's the Marines. You know, why are they so against it? So, I mean, I guess I'm kind of questioning the logic behind, well, everybody else says it's okay, but our most respected division of people is essentially, you know, against it. But
okay, let's
that's just where I question it. But
okay, Jacob, anyway. Let's get a reaction to your comments, one about the methodology. Chris or Arnie, what would you like to react to there?
Well, Chris, you're the political science professor, but I'm trying to figure out he was sort of drawing a line on how the question was asked, and I'm trying to figure out how that changed the answer in the sense of if we repealed this, what is your response? Are you opposed to it? Could you live with it? Would you reject it? I mean, asking someone, do you want to give someone equal rights? Or can you imagine handling someone who has equal rights? I'm just trying to figure out how that changed the dynamic. Everybody knew who was being questioned about this, what exactly the questioners were looking for. I mean, they knew that they were being asked questions about gays serving openly in the military. So mm-hmm. This was not like a bait and switch. So I'm not quite sure that the questions were designed in such a way to elicit a certain response. And in addition to which, they asked all kinds of questions that won't only be useful for don't ask, don't tell. I think the point here was they wanted to make sure that the military was as prepared as possible to embrace this change. And the question is, were they ready? And given the nature of the response, it appears that they are. You're never going to make everyone 100%
happy. Were they ready without putting our nation's security at risk? Let's go to John in Des Moines. John has something to comment on about don't ask, don't tell. Hi, John.
Hi. I just think that these gays... Hello?
Yes, you're still on. I don't know what that was, John. Go ahead.
Okay. I think it parallels this election we just had where they recalled the Supreme Court judges. I am very ashamed of Iowa voters cowering to fear on this. All the Supreme Court did here in Iowa was interpret the Constitution and grant rights.
So, John, not to get off topic, how is this like the don't ask, don't tell?
Well, because it's a so-called gay issue. I was a Marine. I was a Marine in Vietnam, and I wouldn't care if somebody next to me was gay or not. It didn't have an effect on me one way or the other.
When you were in Vietnam as a Marine, were you aware of people in your unit being gay?
No, to tell you the truth, the issue never came up. I was in the Marine Corps for 4 years, and I never knew whether somebody next to me was or wasn't gay. It didn't make any difference to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I was when I came back from Vietnam, I was a clerk, and I had all kinds of people coming in and out of the company office all the time, and nobody knew,
yeah.
You know, nobody cared, and some people were discharged for that at that time. This is in the late 60s, early 70s. And people were discharged. And of course, they're still doing that. But I think it's much more rare than it used to be. And it's only if somebody is trying to make a point about their sexual preference, I think that they're discharged. Thus, the don't ask, don't tell. But again, I don't care one way or the other who somebody goes to bed with. You know, that's the least of my concerns.
It's can they do their job?
Can you
rely on them if you're fighting with them?
Are they competent in what they're doing?
Yep.
And I'm telling you, it hurts our military to have these people just excluded because of this issue. It doesn't make any sense.
John,
or
thank
live
you.
A lie.
Thank you very much for your opinion, John. In Des Moines, we have this tweet from Adam. Adam asks this question, which is an interesting one. Should policy in our civilian-controlled military be democratically selected by the troops? What do you think of that, Chris? Here we have that question from Adam.
Okay, can you repeat that again?
He says, should policy in our civilian-controlled military be democratically selected by the troops. What does this matter that the troops think one way or another if the civilian is controlled? We have civilian control of the military.
You know, that's an interesting point. But I think if you go back to the report on the survey on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the support for this policy went all the way to the top, including Secretary Gates. And so I'm not sure if we would have democratic control in the military, if we would see any difference in terms of favorability toward, you know, the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And just to kind of the two earlier calls with Jacob and John, I think John's remarks echo what was found throughout the report. And with Jacob talking about the methodology as far as the question, you know, asking, are you in favor of this law, basically, if it were enacted versus is it necessary? You can imagine there would be different responses. You're basically asking, you know, is a particular piece of legislation necessary or would you follow the law once enacted? But because they asked so many follow-up questions, I think those concerns are minimal, basically, at this point.
Okay, Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa with us for a few more minutes. I think before the top of the hour, you have to go teach a class. We have about five more minutes with you. Arnie Arneson with us from New Hampshire, political analyst. And let's move on to a couple of other things. On Tuesday, there was a much-anticipated meeting at the White House between President Obama and GOP leaders, their first face-to-face encounter since Democrats suffered those heavy losses on Election Day. Arnie, what is your sense now of how the new GOP order will get along with and get things done with this president?
Well, I feel like we're talking about kabuki theater because everybody walked out and smiled and said it was very productive and thoughtful. And then Senator Reid gets this letter from the Republicans this morning saying basically we're not going to do anything unless you give us tax cuts. We maintain the tax cuts for everyone. And, you know, it's almost like we'll talk, we'll have conversations, let's assign someone to do it. But within hours of leaving that meeting, they drew a line in the sand and said we're not going beyond this. Mm-hmm. What was different before the meeting that turned out after the meeting? Not a thing. So, you know, they may have broken bread, but they didn't break ground. And I think that's what's so depressing about what we're seeing now, is that this is going to be a continuation of partisan politics because the objective is not resolving the problems of the country. The objective is basically changing the leadership in 2012.
During that meeting, there was no consensus on whether to keep the Bush-era tax cuts in place for the middle class and wealthy alike, but the eight bipartisan congressional leaders, the president, agreed to break through their differences by appointing a working group to negotiate a tax agreement. Your thoughts on the likely outcome of that or your reading of that, Chris Larimer?
Well, I'm not sure what another working group on this is going to accomplish. I mean, we have the debt commission already trying to deal with this. We have now this working group, and then you have Obama meeting with the leaders. I mean, at some point, they all kind of need to get together and figure out exactly what they want to do. And having said that, I think if you look at public opinion on this, it's mixed, as would be expected. We haven't had real good public opinion surveys on the details of budgets for a long time. And, you know, just this last week, there were Gallup polls released saying, are you in favor of cutting taxes or reducing spending as a way to deal with the deficit? And most people are in favor of just reducing spending. But then if you ask them in a separate question what needs to be done to reduce the deficit, and one of the things they point out rather prominently is that, you know, we need to raise taxes. And so public opinion is mixed on this, and it's yet to be seen how we're going to deal with it.
Mm-hmm. And I think the American people also, Ben, don't understand that since 1980, the very rich in this country have seen a 300% increase in their income growth. Since 1980, people making around $50,000 have seen about 13% income growth. So what's ironic here is that what the Republicans have done is they're demanding these continuation of the tax cuts that even George Bush knew should expire. Remember this, even George Bush knew that they should expire, and now they're asking that they continue on everyone, including the incredibly wealthy. And at the same time as they do this, they let unemployment benefits basically evaporate as of last night. And when we look at jobs and the economy, every single damn dollar that goes into an unemployment benefit check goes into the economy.
That's right.
Very wealthy people just don't need any more yachts.
Let's remind our listeners that the Congress failed to agree on extending these emergency jobless benefits for the nation's long-term unemployed. The last extension expired last night. The Labor Department estimates that 635,000 people could lose all benefits by December 11th. That's with more than 1.6 million losing them by Christmas. So let's talk quickly about the economic consequences of this and the political consequences. Chris Larimer.
Yeah, I guess one last comment before I head off.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting that the Republicans have kind of put their stake in the tax cuts, saying that, look, we need to pass these, but then, you know, have let the unemployment benefits expire on the basis that there isn't the money to pay for it, and yet they're willing to put everything into the tax cuts without suggesting how are we going to pay for this. And if their real – if their overarching goal is reducing the deficit, reducing the national debt, why aren't we talking about the cost to the budget in terms of the tax cuts rather than only in terms of unemployment benefits?
Mm. How will this play out on a recovery, Arnie?
Well, I think it'll play out significantly on a recovery because, in fact, I think what you know about the very wealthy right now is that they have had these tax cuts for the last decade. So tell me, how are the jobs doing? What we do know is corporate profits saw their highest level ever in the last quarter. How are the jobs doing? How are the very wealthy doing? They're doing – the problem is the very wealthy are doing fine, and the idea that somehow they're investing in this economy and creating jobs just hasn't happened. Yeah. And what's really frightening about the unemployment numbers is that I live in a state, and it's probably true across the entire country. We know what's going on in the real estate market. Normally, if you lost your job, you would want to be flexible and look for work anywhere. The problem is you're a captive tenant. Not only can you not find a job, you can't unload your damn house to find the next job, to go to the next town, to go to the next state. So it's kind of a lose-lose situation. And the fact is that people are so out of touch in Washington that they don't understand the dynamic. It's not just about 10% unemployment, because you know those numbers are artificial. The number is probably three times higher. So I think that they really are cutting off their nose to spite their face, and they're going to hurt everyone else in the economy, whether it's the guy that pumps gas, whether it's the person that works at the food store, because if those people can't pay those bills, they're going to go on local welfare, they're going to go to food kitchens, and in the end, just when you want the economy to begin to sort of move forward, I think they sink it one more time.
Arnie Arneson with us, New Hampshire political analyst. Chris Larimer of the University of Northern Iowa. I believe Chris had to get out of our studio and go teach a class. We want to thank Chris Larimer.
I didn't drive him out.
No, you didn't. I hope I didn't either. Chris Larimer had to go off and teach a course, a political scientist at the University of Northern Iowa. Arnie, also let's mention here the funding of the government into the next year is also an issue. When's the last time Congress failed to fund the government? Was that back in the 90s with Newt Gingrich and Bill Clinton?
Didn't work well for him. I mean, the Republicans should remember how terrible this was for Newt Gingrich. I mean, it was not their finest hour. And as angry as we are about all of this, I think what they're holding hostage is the Star Treaty? They're holding hostage government. They're holding hostage, don't ask, don't tell. There were so many things, and you keep saying people wanted government to move forward, not to basically go in reverse.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's
But there must be a strategy here. If it is as you describe it, as pure and simple, the Republicans would not be taking the tack they are. So what is the hope of the Republicans by taking this tack?
Well, I think right now what they're taking the tack is they want nothing to happen in the lame duck session. You and I both know it. They don't want anything to happen right now because they know that within weeks they are in control. And once they are in control, then they will basically be calling the shots, and they want to be able to do that. And it also puts the Democrats in a very tough position because we know that before the lame duck session is over, the tax cuts basically evaporate.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that was the drop dead date. So some kind of action has to take place before the Republicans come into office, or they will basically pass tax cuts forever in perpetuity, and they'll make them retroactive.
Arnie Arneson, we have just over a minute left. I know we wanted to get to this by your request to talk a little bit about Leslie Nielsen. Actor Leslie Nielsen passed away this week, the age of 84, complications from pneumonia, man whose classic deadpan lines have made us laugh so often. Here is Leslie Nielsen from the film Airplane.
You'd better tell the captain. We've got to land as soon as we can. This woman has to be gotten to a hospital.
A hospital? What is it?
It's a big building with patients, but that's not important right now. Tell the captain I must speak to him.
Certainly.
Captain, how soon can you land?
I can't tell.
You can tell me. I'm a doctor.
No, I mean I'm just not sure.
Or can't you take a guess?
Well, not for another 2 hours.
You can't take a guess for another 2 hours?
No. I mean we can't land for another 2 hours.
Arnie, or should I say Shirley, you've got some thoughts about Leslie Nielsen to end our program today.
I have have to let you know that in 1992 I ran for governor, and there were six of us that were running right before the primary in September. And they asked all the candidates sort of these questions that were not political, you know, what's your favorite color, what's your favorite book, and of course they asked what was your favorite movie. And the other six were saying Casablanca, Cries and Whispers. And what did I say? I said Airplane. And what you need to know is it was my staff was they were horrified. How can you say this? How can you say this? I could not walk down the street for the next 4 weeks without people hugging me and kissing me and playing Airplane over. So I love Leslie Nielsen because it made people remember that in a way, the way he was poking fun at the healthcare system, I thought we should be playing this during healthcare reform. What's a hospital? You know, I was just
Arnie Arneson, we have to go. Thank you for that final input there. New Hampshire political analyst, always a joy to have you on. Arnie Arneson.
Bye-bye, Ben.
The Exchange is produced by Catherine Perkins and Alex Hoyer. Production assistants today from Mitchell Schmidt. Technical support from Dennis Reese. The executive producer of Iowa Public Radio's talk shows, Jeff Schmidt. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. The Exchange at iowapublicradio.org is our email. Our theme music was composed and performed by Dan Knight. We want to thank you, listeners, for calling this hour. Tune in again tomorrow. The Exchange is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks so much for joining us.